So I want to offer you something that I've been thinking about a lot this last week and some of my thoughts around the topic as a way of perhaps having some exploration, some discussion in the whole group about this topic, different people's idea. And that is, how do we discover about ourselves things that we don't already know? So how do we discover aspects of ourselves that are, you know, that are there, but which we don't have a clue that are there? The, you know, if someone came to you, someone you trusted a lot, had really was really perceptive, really knew you well, and came up to you and said, "You have a huge blind spot," and then the person left town. but you know, the person didn't tell you what it is. How would you go about figuring out what that blind spot is? How would you look into it? In the Buddhist teachings, there's a teaching about what's called in English latent tendencies, dormant tendencies, anusaya. And these are tendencies, these are dispositions that we have, habit formations, dispositions, tendencies to react, tendencies to impulses to act in certain ways, which lay there kind of resting in the background. And they can be resting there for decades without even knowing they're there. And then in certain circumstances, they get triggered. And you find yourself really surprised by the degree of hate you could have, or the degree of anger, or the degree of desire, or greed, or confusion that can be there. But those seeds, those tendencies towards desire, or hate, or confusion, kind of, we're always kind of linger there in the background. And it's not so unusual for people to do Buddhist practice in some intensive environment, like going off and being a monk, monk or nun someplace, where it's a very ideal environment, maybe, very quiet, very ideal, but at least a kind of specialized environment. And you can get concentrated, get very peaceful, very wonderful, and people then get to the conclusion, boy, am I hot. You know, or boy, I've really kind of, you know, I've arrived, or this is really great, I'm there, you know. And I remember once, it wasn't in a Buddhist context, but when I was 20 or 21, telling myself, oh, I'll never get depressed again. And that was just before getting more depressed than I've ever had in my life. But, you know, so we get these conclusions about, you know, and so it's you know, it happens in all many domains of life, but you know, Buddhist monastics sometimes have this, and they leave the monastery, and lo and behold, they find that they haven't overcome their certain clingings or attachments or fears or certain kind of habits. It's just been dormant. It's been laying there for a long time, resting. So I think any of us, probably, if we get put in a radically different environment than we're used to, might be surprised at some of our reactions and responses that come out of us in that radically new environment. Oh, I didn't know I had that ability to respond. There's all kinds of beliefs we have, assumptions we have about ourselves, about other people. Some of them are very deeply embedded in the kind of cultural matrix that we're in, the kind of cultural viewpoints that we have. And sometimes it's very hard to see the kind of even our language sometimes seems to be built into certain kind of cognitive processes that kind of structures that are hard to see because we're kind of like, maybe, you know, it's hard to for the fish to see the water it's in or something. It's hard to see some of the kind of underlying structures of our society. I was very surprised, I've often told of practicing in Japan at a monastery and living with a group of about 35 Japanese young monks for about 5 months, and really, really kind of included in their life, kind of which is embedded in their life. They forgot that I was a foreigner. They just kind of lived their life, and I was just there with them in the monastery, living this very intensive life. And every morning we had this temple cleaning session, about 15, 20 minutes, and I would go ahead and do it with them. And I loved it. It was kind of engaged, kind of work, very brisk activity of cleaning. If you clean that quickly at home, you'd be finished in no time. And we just clean. And then one day while doing it, about halfway through my time there, I kind of woke up, or kind of suddenly I had this realization. And I don't know how I got this information, but I'd been there taking in the cues for over a long period of time. And suddenly I understood that I was operating in a different universe than the other Japanese monks. And the different universe was I was operating as an individual doing the cleaning. An individual kind of in a group. They were operating as members of a group. They were as part of an organism. The entity that they were the group. I was an individual among many individuals. They were elements that made up an entity called the group. That makes sense? So I was one among many entities, and they were part of a bigger entity called the group. And so they had a sense of who they were as an individual human being. Maybe you can't even use that language, but who they were as a person was they were part of a community, very intimately part. It was kind of, and as a mostly person who got very much influenced by Western culture and American culture, I saw myself as an individual first, not as a member of a group. And it was really a surprise to me. I had no idea that there could be a different way of understanding what a human being could be. And I, luckily to me at that time, I didn't think that one was better than the other. I just thought, these are really different. How amazingly different. That what it means, the fundamental understanding of what it means to be a human being is different in different cultures. And I hadn't seen it while I kind of stayed in our culture here. I kind of assumed this is the way it is. But because we assume it's the way it is, there's a lot of things that follow on that that seem very logical. They're logical and they follow on that, but the world's not set up that way. It doesn't have to be that way. So in the West, we tend to certainly certain segments of our culture, to overvalue individualism and self-realization, kind of realizing ourselves, realizing our potential for ourselves. And it's a beautiful part of Western culture, but it's also one that can be lend itself to a lot of suffering, especially when we give it absolute value. And that's part of the challenge of some of the fundamental structures of our understanding what it means to be a human being, how it means to be in relationship to others, is when we get fixated on it, it causes suffering. It often causes suffering for people who don't participate in it, but even people who are participating in it cause suffering. There's the kind of things we don't know about how we see other people, our prejudice, our bias, our all kinds of ideas, that, you know, very different ways of understanding life. Oh, I'm remembering now George Lakoff's book. Some of you maybe read George Lakoff recently, where he analyzed the differences between liberals and conservatives in America. And he argues that they have very different ways of understanding what it means to be a person, what it means to be in society and in the world. And they can't talk to each other. They think they can talk to each other because you use words and logic, but they just miss each other because the basic assumptions are kind of invisible, maybe to each of them, or how different they are from each other. And probably most of you have had some kind of experience of waking up and realizing, wow, things are not what I assumed to be, or wow, I see something new about myself I didn't see before. You know, how could I have missed it for so long? Also in the Buddhist tradition, they talk about seeds, that somehow in our psyche, embedded in our psyche, in places that are hidden, are seeds. Some of these are latent tendencies, but also seeds to different how we behave and the influences that affect our lives plant seeds. And those seeds lay dormant, and then sooner or later, when the conditions are right, they can blossom. And so some of those seeds are seeds of goodness, that if we act on kind acts or are generous, then we're planting seeds so in the future there's more likely that those will sprout, those seeds. If we act on hate or ill will or fear, that they leave embedded somewhere in the psyche certain seeds, and those seeds sooner or later can sprout, can come to the surface. So kind of what's not seen, but there that might influence us. And one of the things I'm trying to say here is often things influence us, the things that do influence us often we don't see it. So if that's the case, how do we explore it? How do we discover that? And one of the first ways, I believe, is to be interested, is to have a kind of working assumption. Maybe it's a kind of humility. I don't think I know myself very well. There's parts of myself maybe I don't really know. So they're kind of like, you know, okay, maybe I'm open to feedback, I'm open to questioning myself, rather than being super confident in my beliefs, my views, what has to happen, my needs, maybe there's some openness of questioning. What's really going on here? Can I look more carefully? So having a willingness to question is important. Another thing that has been very useful in my life, and this is one of the reasons why it's come up this week, is to put myself in situations where there's some risk involved, where I kind of push the envelope, in a sense, push the limit of what my understanding is or what my who I am. In other words, don't be too polite. You know, if you're really polite all the time, it's very nice for other people, perhaps, but if you're really polite, sometimes you hide from yourself. And I find that with certain friends, certain situations, that I really value when people are much more immediate and direct, and maybe not so polite. If in the context of that conversation, there's a willingness to be open and get feedback and talk about what's going on, so that if I'm being really careful, I get different feedback from people than if I'm being a little bit careless. If I'm being a little bit careless, someone say, "Gil, did you just notice what you just did?" Or maybe I'll notice. And sometimes, you know, maybe I'm not, I can make all kinds of mistakes and misperceptions and come from the wrong place at times. And if I'm really careful and don't take risks, I might not even see that. So there's a place and a time for taking risks and kind of having a kind of rough and tumble of things to clarify what's really there. I think sometimes I've been involved in diversity training. People look at racism and things like that. And it seems to work a lot better if people are not too polite. If they're in the training, what we're trying to do is expose our basic beliefs, our views. And once they're exposed, then they can be worked with. But if they're not exposed and everybody's polite and holding back, then no one knows. Everybody's afraid of each other. Who is that person? I don't know. Sometimes it's better for people to know who you are than it is to kind of be polite and you don't really know what's going on and you're going to get it to, you know, it's going to come to you through the back door. So there is a time and a place for being impolite. And hopefully you're very wise about how you do that. Maybe it's a time when you have permission. You ask the person, you know, can we have permission not to be so careful here? And maybe if we're not so careful, we kind of do a kind of active give and take. Maybe we'll kind of reveal things that we don't really know. And so maybe in those kinds of circumstances where it's kind of set up to do that. There's a saying in England, I've been told, that you don't really know England unless you leave England. And so this idea of if you're always in a particular environment, step outside of that environment allows you to look back and see it in a new way. And a lot of people who go to another culture, especially if it's a very different culture from American culture, come back to the culture they're used to, and they talk about having culture shock. It's just so different. It's so shocking. So like suddenly they see things they didn't see before, things that they accepted. Another thing that I found to be helpful is something like meditation practice. Meditation practice, when it's done thoroughly or well, especially Vipassana practice, can be seen as a process of deconstruction. That we have all these formations, all these views, all these assumptions and beliefs that we operate on, that sometimes drive our emotions, sometimes drive our intentions and our views in the world. And we think that they're just kind of there effortlessly. We just see, so we look out there and we see, we think it's effortless. So, remember when I was 19, I went, it was the first time as an adult, alone, without my folks, I went to a non-Western culture. I went to Morocco. And I was surprised that after being there for a while, that I felt kind of, when I walked around the street, I felt a kind of strange feeling that I kind of called being refreshed. I didn't quite understand why I was kind of refreshed, or kind of a little more ease in my mind than I normally would have. And I tried to understand what was going on, and this was my understanding, I hope it's right, was that in Morocco, back in a long time ago, in the early 70s, a lot of the people there wore the traditional costumes, or the traditional clothes in Morocco. They wore yalabas, these men wore these kind of robes, and women wore their thick robes and stuff. And there were very few people wearing Western clothes. And I had no basis upon which to put these different people that I saw on the streets into a category. They weren't, you know, jocks, or they weren't, you know, they weren't conservatives or liberals, or they weren't, you know, I had all, you know, I couldn't put them in, you know, a normal category. And what I realized leaving Morocco was that when I went around in the West back then, you know, I was very quickly, very effortlessly, seemingly, had an assumption about who people were, or put them in a category. But it wasn't so effortless. It took a little bit of effort. And so when I walked around the streets of Morocco, that effort couldn't happen. And so I felt a little bit more refreshed because of that. So there's activities in the mind that seem effortless in one context, but take effort. So when you do meditation well, get concentrated and get still, it's understood as a deconstruction process where you begin letting go of the efforts to hold your worldview, hold your understandings in place. And there are a lot of understandings that are kind of floating in our minds that we're keeping there in place that are invisible to us. And as the mind gets stiller and quieter, it has to let go of a lot of that effort and a lot of those views. And slowly, slowly, there's a deconstruction process where we begin deconstructing the worldview, the self-understanding that we've had that's come from our lifetime experience, our culture, our family, ourselves, all kinds of things. And so it gets deconstructed and deconstructed, and eventually you come close to zero, where there's almost no construction going on at all. Almost no kind of that kind of formations or views or overlays on our experience. All kinds of very, very deeply rooted ideas of who we think we are and what we need are let go of. And then the challenging question is, when those are not operating, who are we? And we find that it's possible to operate, it's possible to be alive in a very alive, vigorous, happy way without the presence of views which in the past were inconceivable to do without. So meditation can be this deconstruction process. And then once you're well deconstructed, then the fascinating thing is to notice how you reconstruct it. There's an opportunity to how you re-import or recreate or bring up all the old things again. And some people get really disappointed in this process because they feel, wow, it's so peaceful and now all the stuff comes back. But it's a very important part of mindfulness practice is to, when you're able to deconstruct well, is to pay very careful attention at the reconstruction process. Some people will overvalue in mindfulness the deconstruction process because it's calming for the most part. And they overemphasize being calm and peaceful. And then they don't pay enough attention at the reconstruction process. So coming back from a three-month retreat, there's a lot of that, I would imagine. Three-month, you know, reconstruction. And that's a really important part of practice, is to start noticing how the beliefs, the views, the understandings that pop up. Because there's an opportunity to see something when it first pops up that might not be possible once it gets overlaid by a lot more constructs. When it gets too complicated in the mind, you can't see the simple building blocks of it. So one of the reasons to do long intensive retreats is to do that deconstruction process. And some people report it's really liberating to have so much disappear that just kind of was burdensome to be carrying around all the time. The other, and then related to that question, that issue of retreat, I wanted to say that some commentators or people, teachers, will differentiate between what they call a fast path of practice and what's been called a complete path of practice. And fast paths of practice are those which are fast. You know, supposed to get you to enlightenment really quickly. You know, immediately. You know, just really quickly. And so, in our tradition, for example, sometimes people focus a lot on concentration. Let's just get as concentrated as we can and just go deep and just have that transformation, that enlightenment thing. But there's a lot of Buddhists offer fast practices, and it's reasonable, you know, if you want to be efficient. And, you know, especially Americans like to be fast. You know, so we have all kinds of other things we want to do with our life besides get enlightened. So, you know, let's get it over with. But then there's the complete, in contrast to that, there's the complete path. And that's the kind of focus where the emphasis is not on some narrow and quick approach to being strongly concentrated and having some transformative experience, but rather it's to incorporate or include the width and breadth of our life in part of the practice, to refine ourselves, to purify ourselves, to understand ourselves at our emotional level, our cognitive level, our physical level, our interpersonal level, to understand and address all those issues in practice, to include all of it as part of practice. And what I've noticed is that the people who tend to take the fast approach, or the narrow approach, tend to leave out huge parts of their life in the practice, or you know, all kinds of places which are unknown or kind of kept at bay, and when there's an attempt to try to be more complete, and to look at our emotions, to look at our interpersonal life, to look at our cognitive beliefs and assumptions, that those people are a lot easier to live with. They tend to be know themselves more. They tend to be much more refined or balanced or just kind of more mature in many ways. They might be less enlightened. Because sometimes I've known people who've gone, you know, in the understanding of some Buddhist traditions, they've taken the fast approach and have had some really significant experiences, realization kind of experience. But they actually became kind of arrogant afterwards. And, you know, look at me, I'm special. And it's harder to do that if you take the complete approach, where you're actually willing to look at all of yourself and work on it and refine it. So I want to offer two other things that ideas I've had about how to work with the unknown parts of ourselves. And then I'll open it to you, and you guys can talk about your experience and what you've learned in your life about this. One is, I found it very important to pay attention to the physical body. The body holds a lot of different things. I've almost come to the conclusion that nothing happens without the body participating. even the subtlest thoughts have a physical aspect to them. And if you pay attention to your body, there's information there. There's kind of access points into what's going on, that is sometimes much more penetrating than if you're trying to think your way into things. Thinking is often kind of one-sided or blinded or kind of partial. And the body kind of is an access point. So much so that, to paraphrase, I think, Jung, I would say that the royal road to the unconscious is the body. To go into the body, feel what's going on in the body, use the cues, use the tensions of the body, the holding patterns of the body, the places of softness and vulnerability in the body, to kind of go in and explore what's going on under the radar of your thinking. That's one thing. The other thing I found, similar to this, but not exactly the same, is to use our suffering as a point in, that suffering is our stress, our tension, the places where we feel uncomfortable, to use discomfort our place as a place to stop and look more carefully, to become really sensitive to discomfort, or, you know, stress, tension, and to study that and look at it and go behind it and see what's going on here, what's prompting it. Most problematic ways in which we don't know about ourselves, ways in which we don't know ourselves that are causing problems for ourselves and others, will express itself subtly or grossly as some form of tension in the system. And so if you pay attention to tension and stop for it and look at it, you'll learn a lot about yourself. You'll learn probably everything you need to know by stopping and looking. And I know in many situations where I'll feel tense or stressed or something, and for some reason or other, I don't really stop and pay attention to that. Other things are more important. Or I don't want to look. Or I don't want to bother. Or something. But tension, to stop and look, oh, what's going on here? You'll learn so much by stopping and looking at that. And it's a doorway to feeling the opposite, to feeling at ease. So those are my thoughts. I'm very curious now to hear from you. What do you think about this topic? For those of you whom it's relevant. Right behind you.
I'll repeat it. I couldn't agree more. I'm really touched by Gil's talk today because many of you know I've had a history of a brain injury about 3 years ago now. And I felt like, in a way, I had a profound experience of my sort of whole sense of who I was got shocked, if you will. And I went through a process acquiring sort of a short-term memory problem. But it was like I'm sort of rediscovering since that time who I am, and what Gil said about constructing myself. You know, I have strong memories, some of the memories I have of who I was before, and I have little cues to tell me where those, you know, ideas came from. But I'm also discovering that there is a constant constitution, if you will, of who I think I am happening all the time. And another interesting thing about this is that because my brain has been tested to say that I don't process that fast, I feel like I've got sort of an advantage in that I'm able to see it form more easily than before. I just wanted to share that you know, even the mind and the brain are able to heal itself, and you can see something good from it. It doesn't have to all be so negative. That sounds so poetic anyway. But I'm just so glad to be here, and I'm so happy that we have such a wonderful teacher in Gil, and that you all are here part of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl. The thing about slowing down the mind so you can see, I mean, that's partly why concentration or calmness is a very important part of meditation. You get calm enough, then you can see more clearly. You can see the beginning of things, or the arising of thoughts and ideas and formations. If you're really speedy or agitated, it's hard to see. And then also, if I may, maybe it's a little bit too personal, but with Cheryl, I mean, I knew her for a long time before she had a very dramatic brain injury. And one of the things that I saw is that she had a really good practice before her injury. And those planted really good seeds. And those seeds survived. And they kind of, you know, like all these good seeds are kind of like what was left. And they kind of, you know. So who knows, you know, when your mind's going to go. the rest of us. But, you know, you might want to think about the seeds that you're planting because someday you might need those seeds when everything else is taken away. So if you don't mind taking the mic, I think we have...
There it is in front.
There's two of them, aren't there?
It's in front.
Oh, I have it. Things you don't know.
As you were talking, I was thinking about a documentary I watched on Link TV last night, which some of you may have seen. It's called Doing Time, Doing Vipassana. And it's about teaching Vipassana to prisoners in India. And one of the things, for several of them, they realized in doing the practice their feelings, I guess for the first time, about what they had done, the crimes they had committed, and some of them sought forgiveness from the victims, like if they'd killed someone and they sought forgiveness from the family, but they had these feelings of guilt for the first time. So I think that was the kind of self-realization at a very extreme level of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes if you deconstruct enough or get calm enough or let go enough, that it allows deeper movements to happen. They don't happen when there's no space because the mind is so filled with, you know, anxious activity. And so sometimes deep movements of forgiveness or deep movements of purification can happen, which is an example of that. And we have that movie, the video, in our library here. It's a great video about, so you might check it out from the library here.
I'm not sure this is exactly the same kind of thing, but I know that when I found myself in situations that were very foreign to me, that it's made me aware of shortcomings and brought about change. And a couple of things that come to mind, one when we were traveling in foreign countries, and you see signs that are in a language you can't understand or posters, how uncomfortable that can make you feel. And what it did, it made me realize some of my shortcomings or tolerance for other people that were in that situation, and made me change some behaviors when I came back, when I see people in that situation more wanting to help or asking if there's something I can do. And then another time was when we were in China, what it felt like to be a minority, to be walking down the street and really be very different than everyone else you're looking at. And it brought about different feelings in me and changed, I think, brought about changes in behavior.
Oh, yeah. So back there. Should stay, best to keep the mic on once it's on.
Is that on?
Yes.
I found just asking to, could the universe show me my blind spot? And the next day something comes up, and if I'm aware, awake, or really want to look at it, it's right there.
So asking the universe, and also you can ask specific people. Somebody knows you well. What is it? Over there. You pass it down, it's right down to your left.
Oh, it's on? Okay. Sometimes I'm painfully aware of my my weaknesses or my horribleness or whatever, my mistakes. And I think it's also important to think of blind spots in terms of blind spots about how loving we are and how wonderful we are and what kinds of ways we can become more aware of those blind spots as well.
Yes. Yes, I agree. It's a very good point.
I think that we all do our practice, or it progresses in different ways. There's a lot of personalities and whatever that affect that. And when I started about 20 years ago, there was just so much emotion. That was all that I was practicing with. And slowly, some of the emotions just started balancing, and then there were my thoughts. And almost 20 years later, I'm working in the body. It's because that's what's more prominent, but I have the seeds of working with the emotions and the thoughts, and now that's being related to what comes up in the body very directly. And so whatever order we take it in, it's all there. Mm-hmm. And I've been hoping the last few years as I age, and that never knowing if the mind, if Alzheimer's, or you know, what's going to happen when. And I was hoping that the seeds planted in the body would be a place to practice if the mind changes.
Yeah, good point.
I very much appreciate your distinction between the group identity of the East and the individual identity of the West, having grown up with that dichotomy. And I just wanted to comment.
Very intimately. You mind telling the group how intimately that dichotomy exists for you? Do you mind telling the group how intimately that it exists?
I was raised in Thailand, and that was where my group identity grew. And my father, my mother being English, was teaching me my Western individual identity, which I then had to make manifest when we moved here. And my comment was that when you have the group identity, your little idiosyncrasies of the body and your preferences, your food preferences, your sleep preferences, whatever, are much more accepted in the group, whereas in the Western, where we are individuals, it seems as if we end up conforming much more as individuals. So that was my comment.
Great. The illusion of individualism.
I thought it was interesting, this idea you presented of kind of letting go and observing how one acts in different situations. And I think I found for myself that people seem to be a very powerful catalyst for seeing different parts of myself come out and challenging my view of how I am. It seems that, you know, when I'm with different people, I tend to, you know, it brings up different things, and sometimes I'm really surprised. I'm like, wow, I'll say something I really don't care for in them, and I notice these bring up those same things in myself, kind of playing to them. Or in my relationships, sometimes I'm I had this experience of coming back from retreat over the summer, and it's very peaceful, and I've been sending out loving kindness to the whole universe. Things very compassionate, and my girlfriend's like, wow, you're sort of very withdrawn. Darn.
Yeah. It's good to get feedback. it prompted a couple of stories from my life of when I was about 20, early 20s. I lived for a while at a large spiritual commune in the early 70s called The Farm in Tennessee. And when I went there, I just dropped in by chance and stayed for a while. And I loved it there. And I felt very much at home there. But after a while, I started feeling uncomfortable. And one of the reasons I left was, there were like 800 people there, this hippie commune. I felt like we were all, it was too homogenous of a society, and everybody, we're all these white, mostly white, middle class hippies, and with so many shared views and values from that time. And I started, even though I shared all these ideas and values with them, I said, I don't know if this is safe to be around people who all have the same ideas as I do. It's maybe safer to be around people who have different views, different ideas, to get the feedback and the challenges. And I didn't feel it was safe to be in that kind of homogenous group. And then the reason I went to San Francisco Zen Center is to kind of be there and live there, was that I found that when I went there, the people there mirrored me in such a way that I could see myself much more better than I could among my own friends, who kind of supported me rather than mirrored me, kind of, you know, codependent kind of thing, right? And so I found it really good to put myself in situations where I was challenged, where I got to see parts of myself that normally I wouldn't be seen by the people who are, you know, because of the maturity or whatever it was that mirrored it. So someone else said something.
I guess my thought is to look at the situation I'm in and see what it asks of me. And usually my idea of what that would be is smaller, actually, than what is needed. And I guess, like, recently I talked in front of a group of 270 people just because I thought I needed to do it. And that wasn't who I thought I was at all. You know, prior to that, I guess it made me realize I really don't know who I am, you know, that I just have to show up and see what's elicited from me. Like just now, I turned my ring around upside down, and it looks really strange. And it seems like, you know, it looks like there's something wrong with it to me. And I guess that reminds me that any behavior that I do that's not my normal thing seems strange, you know. And so I have an idea of myself that's smaller than I am. And so if I just look to the situation, it seems like maybe I'll expand a little bit.
Beautiful. Maybe I don't know if the mic is.
I've been teaching in prison for 2 years now, and when I go there down at Soledad, everyone looks the same. They're all dressed the same, same haircuts, all shaven. And it makes me aware every time I go that my mind is got this running chatter going all the time. Excuse me. It's basically making up my world around me based on all kinds of assumptions, the large number of which are incorrect. And it keeps me from seeing life as it really is. My mind is just relentless at it.
It's good to know that. So we practice, some of us practice mindfulness meditation in order to see that much better, see it better than we would if we didn't meditate. And we practice mindfulness in order to get calm enough, in order to have a better platform from which to see, and perhaps a kind of inner stability that allows us to see uncomfortable things or difficult things or strange things and not be thrown off by it. So I hope during this next week, all of you will find a good, appropriate way to get uncomfortable as you discover new aspects of what's really going on. So thank you very much.